You're listening to the Big Three of B2B Leadership Podcast with Mike Faherty, where world-class business leaders share their secrets for personal, organizational, and market growth. Gain powerful insights from industry leaders that have been tested by the fire.
Well, welcome everyone. Welcome to the Big Three of B2B Leadership. My name is Mike Faherty. I'm your host today. I had the pleasure of being joined by Tim Brown. Tim, as the owner and founder of McAllister Brown & Associates, he helps companies navigate the uncertain waters of federal, state, and local government contracts. He started his firm with a handful of seasoned partners and nearly 30 years working with some of the biggest federal contractors in the world. This is a fascinating topic for me, and I'm excited to speak with Tim and help him or give him an opportunity to help us understand why we should be considering government contracts, what businesses are best suited for this type of strategy, and we hope that he'll also give us an overview of what is involved in pursuing these types of government contracts for you and your business. So welcome, Tim. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me, Mike.
I appreciate that. Well, look, so can you tell me a little bit about how you found your way into government contracting, into this business? It's not something a lot of people are really drawn to. So tell me a little bit about your background and how you got involved.
Yeah, my father was a naval submarine guy, both enlisted and officer. He was a Mustang. And I had gone to college, actually. I wanted to be a stockbroker. And right about the time I was getting ready to graduate, there was a little mini crash. And I had already been interning with the government because of what my father did. And rather than go to the stock market and try and build up my quals there, I decided to stay with federal government contracting, and I stayed there my entire career. So
that's awesome. So you were kind of born into this.
I was.
So then you do this for nearly 30 years, you have some pretty interesting stops along the way. Why don't you kind of break down some of the places that you've spent some time?
Sure. I started my career with what's called Navy Area Theater Ballistic Missile Defense under the BIMDO, Ballistic Missile Defense Organization. That organization is actually now called MDA, Missile Defense Administration. And I was there for a few years. My background is government finance. I'm degreed in finance. And I was managing about $1.5 billion for the Navy straight out of school, watching seven-year funding, all that kind of stuff. And I was about 2 years into my career, and they were getting ready to terminate that program and actually start MDA. And I was approached by somebody to do a $450 million bid over 10 years. And from a pricing standpoint, I helped them do that. That company was ADI Technology, but they were in the process of being bought by Ross Perot of Perot Systems, of course, of EDS as well. And I did that for them. We won that bid, and I managed that contract for close to the next 10 years for Perot Systems. Since then, I worked for a small company that made satellite packs, and they were bound to be put out of business by smartphones, and they were sometime after I left them. And then I was with a large research and development company that was a nonprofit named Concurrent Technologies Corporation that has done some really interesting research and development for the federal government. And that's basically the last 28 years before I started my company.
So let's talk about that. So tell me a little bit about your company and how you decided it was time to start your own firm.
Well, I actually was doing a bid for an affiliate to CTC, a large bid, and it was around $80 million. And we brought in some specialized consultants to help us do that bid. And it's actually pretty standard within the industry, but you know, like hourly rates for consultants are usually in the $150 to $200 range, maybe even as high as $250 if they're high-level ex-government employees. And proposals tend to run 1% to 2% of the proposal value. So doing this $180 million bid, bringing in some proposal and business development consulting help, cost that small company about $350,000, $400,000. And I actually was talking with some friends of mine and said, you know, I don't know how small businesses, if they're not backed by a large company, can even do this. So, you know, through several conversations over some time, we decided, you know, there's a better way to help businesses get into and perform work with the federal government that doesn't just do business development or doesn't do just proposal management, but does everything that you need to understand to do business with the government. And we started a company to do that.
So when was that? When did you guys actually launch the business?
We actually launched a year ago this month. I think we're within a couple of days of when we launched. So we're 12 months in at this point right now.
Well, that's exciting. So, so you have seen a ton of contracts as, you know, over your career. You've been involved in a number of massive contracts. You mentioned several, you know, $100 million contracts, even $1 billion contracts. So what are some of the biggest mistakes that you've seen companies make when pursuing a growth strategy that's based on government contracts?
Well, Mike, that's an interesting question. I think there's actually two things that companies do wrong when they're going after federal work. The first one is that they have a tendency to just find one bid that they think that is tailor-made for the type of work that they do. And really, the right way to do it is to build a strategy that goes out not only months, but goes out years, that allows you to go after multiple bids that are in your arena. The second mistake I think that companies make is they assume that you can just write to a solicitation and you're, you know, again, if it's in your wheelhouse, you have a good shot of winning. And the truth of the matter is that a large percentage of losses are not because companies aren't technically acceptable. It's because they don't actually follow the requirements or criteria of a government solicitation and get thrown out for noncompliance. So those two things are probably the most major factors, in my opinion, of not winning work within the federal government.
So building up a pipeline of multiple opportunities, just hedging your bets.
Yeah, well, the government industry average win rate is 29% right now. And actually, in the last 30 years that I've been doing this, it's hovered right around 30% the whole time. I think the highest in that 30 years was around 33%, and the lowest was around 27%. So yeah, I mean, you know, I'm a numbers guy and I like hedging those bets. So I'd like to make sure that my clients are bidding at least enough at least the level that they want to win, to ensure that they have the best opportunity to win. And also that that work is in their wheelhouse or at least enough is in their wheelhouse that they can get a good partner to go after that work.
That's interesting. So I mean, I want to make sure I understood that number. 30% or 29% today of people who bid on contracts win the contract?
That's right. A large portion, the loss rate is about 3/4.
So I mean, you need at least three. You get three and the odds are in your favor that you've got to win, right?
Yeah, and actually an industry standard that people use is what's called the 110-3-1 rule. And it's a little bit of a mouthful, but for every 100 potential bids that you look at, 10 are ones that you're going to be interested in, 3 are ones that you're going to bid, and 1 is one that you're going to win. Now, I personally use the 110-4-1 rule. Where I try to bid at least 4 for every 1 win. Right. So again, it's all about putting a good strategy in place. And honestly, if you keep in your mind that you're only going to win about 30% or I use a quarter, 25% of the bids that you put in, you know, you can then understand as you lose things, how to better position yourself to win the next one. So asking the right questions of the government after you lose, or even after you win, asking the right questions can put you in a position to better understand how to bid the next one.
So winning a bid doesn't necessarily mean that you got any business though, right?
Well, it depends on the contract, right? There are contracts that are blanket agreements. There's lots of those. And a common terminology is either MATOC or MAC IDIQ. MAC IDIQ means multiple award, indefinite delivery, indefinite quantity contract, where there's multiple vendors who get on that contract. And then MATOC is multiple award task order based contract. They're basically the same kind of contract. But yeah, there's contracts like that. And then there's single award contracts. You can actually have single award IDIQs where there's an unknown amount of money that will be put through that contract, but there's no competition for you. The government just funds it as they go. Mm-hmm.
So do you see customers slip into the mindset or struggle with the mindset of, I need to be the lowest price here so that I get this award, and then they end up hurting their business rather than helping it? Have you ever seen that?
Yeah, you do see that. And the government swings, you know, between what they call best value contracts and LPTA, which is lowest price technically acceptable, depending on administrations or what's important to the government at the time. When we had the Great Recession, a lot of government contracts went LPTA, and that does hurt business. As a matter of fact, I think it hurts the government as well. We're starting to see them swing back to best value contracts, where it's not necessarily the lowest price they're looking for, but the best solution for the price that they're going to pay. And that's better for business and better for the government. You know, with LPTA type contracts, you end up with a lot of contractors who not only undercut that contract, but lowball the salaries of potential employees. And then you end up with a revolving door where you're losing good talent on a regular basis. So, you know, it depends on the type of business, right? There are some companies that focus on price, and those companies will focus on the LPTAs because a lot of times they can beat other companies. But other companies that have, you know, high precision or high expertise in services, whatever it might be, we'll look for the best value type contracts.
So what are the criteria today that would exclude you from being considered? You know, is it type of organization structure, location? What about international companies that are based in other places? Talk a little bit about what are some of the restrictions.
Well, you know, anybody in the U.S. and a lot of foreign companies can register to do business with the federal government. It's not an overly difficult process to get registered to do business with the government. The government does put some restrictions on certain countries, you know, that we would consider security issues, such as maybe China or Russia or even India. There's actually lots of foreign companies that do business with the federal government. As a matter of fact, the F-35 contract, the Raptor, a lot of the subcontractors are international because it's an international program. It's not just U.S. based, even though U.S. is the one who is putting out the contract. So there are lots of foreign companies in that. But if a company wants to register to do business with the government, it's fairly simple. You make sure that you have a DUNS number, and you register on what's called SAM.gov, S-A-M. It takes a couple days to input the information, and not because it's hard information, but because you got to gather it all. And then probably if you need what's called a CAGE code, a commercial and government entity code, the government automatically sends that to the IRS to get that code for you, or Department of Revenue to get that information for you. And that takes about 10 to 15 days. So you can be registered to do business with the government in about 10 to 15 days if you're quick at entering the information into SAM.
So take me through, I think you kind of started right there. So what I was wanting you to do is maybe take me through, let's say I'm listening to this and I'm for the first time I've ever considered that maybe I should do business with the federal government. Maybe that would make sense for me. Just kind of take me through at a 30,000 foot level, kind of what the process looks like from start to end. From, hey, I've decided I'd like to pursue government contracts to, you know, maybe I get my first dollar from the government.
Yeah. So the first step, in my opinion, is not only registration in SAM, but determination of what kind of business you are. And what I mean by that is the government has not only small business contracts that are set aside, but also disadvantaged business contracts that are set aside. And of course, they have large business contracts. But within those set aside contracts, then even though you're a disadvantaged company, the government gives you some advantage where larger companies can't go after it, or companies who don't have the same disadvantages you cannot go after it. So you're limiting the competition.
Can I just stop you right there? Can you explain sure. disadvantaged companies? Like what does that mean?
Yeah. And I was just about to go there, Mike.
Sorry.
So, yeah. No, you're fine. So yeah, there's four major disadvantaged types of companies. One is the 8A program, which is typically minority, but it also includes economically disadvantaged companies. There's woman-owned small businesses. There are SDVOSBs, which are service-disabled veteran-owned small businesses. And there are, and a subset of that is veteran-owned small businesses. They don't get the same advantage as a SD gets, but they do get some advantage. And then there are hub zones, which are historically underutilized business zones. And you can actually look up a map of hub zone. It's called hubzone.map, I think, but you can actually look and see if your company falls within a hub zone. Those are geographic areas where individuals are disadvantaged. And the only thing I would caution people on some of those is there are criteria you have to meet. The 8A program has criteria that you have to meet. Hub zone has criteria, and so does service disabled veteran-owned small businesses. But the SBA has that kind of information, and you apply for certification for those, and that gives you an advantage on the government side, even though they're considered disadvantaged companies.
So those are the disadvantaged companies. So first, figure out, do I fit into one of those categories? What kind of business I am, and then what category might I fit in to give me an advantage or some incentive to pursue?
Right. And then, you know, after that, once you're registered in SAM, so once you've determined what type of company you are, and I would not discourage large companies or small businesses without a disadvantage. My only point is know what you are before you go down the path, because you want to get all the paperwork out of the way so you're focused on going after business. But once you're registered, you actually can start bidding immediately. The website for looking at solicitations, or at least the major website for looking at solicitations, is called betasam.gov. And you can go in there and do searches and find bids that are in the areas that you work in, and either track them or go after them immediately if they're already out for proposal.
So that's whenever the proposal gets submitted, and that's really where a lot of people fall down, isn't it?
Yeah. So the proposal, I said earlier that a lot of companies lose on the proposal phase because, you know, the government, they try to make it as fair as possible, but they also try to make it as easy on them as possible too. So if you don't follow the requirements of the solicitation, including margin size or font size or font type, you actually can be thrown out before they even read your technical. So it's good to make sure you understand all the requirements of the solicitation before you start to write to it, and make sure that you're meeting all that criteria, because you don't want to be thrown out for font size when you have a really good capability that the government needs and wants. So that process is about 30 days from the time the solicitation is released to the time you submit your proposal is about 30 days. The time that it takes the government to award is a lot of times dependent on how big the contract is. So I've seen, you know, $15,000 bids be awarded in 3 days, and I've seen $100 million bids take 12 months. Typically, though, it's between 30 and 90 days, depending on how many bids the government gets. And so you're looking at probably from the day you're registered to the day that you submit a proposal, at the minimum, it's about 30 days, but it might be 60 while you're building a pipeline. And then another 30 to 90 days before you see a win or a loss on that contract that you bid.
So now I've got my contract, I've been given my contract award. And so now I'm welcome to do business, and let's say there's multiple awards, right? So I'm welcome to do business with this agency or this department. for some specific scope of work. And maybe there are three, four, five other folks who got a similar award or were awarded on that same contract. What's next for me? How do I start making money?
Well, so with those types of contracts, if it's not a single award contract where you've got a funding line already, but a MAC IDIQ, then your next stop is to start having conversations with the clients underneath that contract. You want to get ahead of any information you can get so that you're in the best position to win it. Now, a lot of times you will know, especially if it's a specific agency, you will know who the contracting officer is, and you can ask them, hey, can you tell me the technical points of contact so that I can have conversations with them. Other times you might already know who the technical point of contact is and be having conversations about upcoming bids and those kinds of things. Some contracts release plans years in advance. Seaport Next Generation, you can go in there and search earlier bids to find out when they're going to come out again. And that's one good thing about the government. You can plan years in advance because the government does a good job of planning. I think where the government struggles, which is why they need industry, is on execution. You know, a lot of people don't realize how big the federal government is. It's the largest employer in the world. It is a third of our national GDP. So a third of our spending comes from the federal government. And because they're the largest employer in the world, and because they're a third of our GDP, they buy every product that the commercial market buys. You know, I had a company reach out to me some time ago at the beginning of COVID and ask me if I could do a search on gowns for them. This company made outdoor furniture, but they were interested in gowns because of PPE and trying to pivot while nobody was buying outdoor furniture. And so I said, sure, I'll do a search for you. And I looked for PPE things in the federal government and all that kind of stuff. But at the end of that, I said, you know, just for the heck of it, I'm going to check outdoor furniture and see if the government buys any outdoor furniture. And sure enough, they buy outdoor furniture every year, typically for embassies and things like that. But if they'll buy outdoor furniture, they're buying everything else. Right? So pens, pencils, bedding. It doesn't matter if you have a product or a service that the government would be interested in, it's well worth looking at.
And so how does your business work? So tell me how you fit into that equation. So that's the spectrum. That's sort of the continuum of doing business with the government. You step in there to help these companies navigate these waters. Can you just kind of describe what your services look like?
Yeah. So I said earlier that typical consultants do one piece of the puzzle in helping you with the federal government. They might be a door opener or a door closer from a business development standpoint. They might be a proposal manager or a cost estimator that can help you do those pieces. But there aren't a lot of companies that take all of the necessary pieces and roll them together into one company. And that's why we formed our company, because the businesses that we target are typically not currently doing federal work or state or local work. They're doing commercial work and are interested in the federal government, but don't know where to start. So what we offer is tip to tail government contracting, almost as if we're a drop-in division to your company. And that allows you to continue to work on your commercial growth, where we help you build up your federal side work and your pipeline and all those kinds of things. So we have people that do research. That research can be pipeline building, looking at potential partners or competition, looking at government organizations to see where you might fit into those organizations. We have business developers who can go and meet with clients for you if you need them to, or schedule meetings with you to meet with the clients, either way. The only caveat to that has been difficult during COVID. It's the one piece that's difficult to do right now because nobody's in the offices. But we have been successful in getting meetings for our clients. Usually it's over Zoom or over a phone call. My background is financial management, so I can help with building government budgets. The government actually follows what they call CAS compliance, cost accounting system compliance. It's a little more stringent than GAAP, but the same principles are involved. So I help build budgets that are compliant to what the government needs. I help with indirect rates, which are your overheads and the G&As. The government likes to see them in a certain way. I can help with cost strategy and forward pricing rates, so future rates, things like that. We have proposal management, so we can help you write the proposal. We can help make sure that it's compliant to what the government needs. The only piece of that we don't do is technical writing because we're in so many industries. And then we have contracts expertise to help you understand the government law that's called the FAR, the Federal Acquisition Regulations, and to help with negotiations after an award if they're necessary. They're not always necessary.
So there might still be another negotiation. You might give them a price and they might come back and say, thanks, but can you get a little better?
Yeah, but if it's a full and open competition or a competitive bid, there's not typically a negotiation. There might be, but it's not typical. It's typically if it's a single award or a sole source type contract where they would come back and say, okay, you had no competition. We want to see what's in your costs. And you know, you show them their costs, and then of course they want to negotiate certain things down. So we can help with that. We can help with what regulations they have to follow, the government has to follow, so that you're not, and the government, by the way, does not want to hurt your company. They don't want to see you lose money, but they do want to make sure they're getting the best price because they don't want to be buying $50 hammers and things like that. If you remember back in the 80s and 90s, there was all talk about those kinds of things. What I think a lot of companies don't understand is probably if they're buying a $50 hammer, it's probably very specialized for something that they need and had to be run separate from a major production line on hammers. But the government wants to make sure that they're getting the best deal because they're spending taxpayer dollars to do what they need to do.
Yeah, no, I get that. I remember, I think it was Newsweek had the $50 hammer. We had that issue at my house. I remember reading it. So does everyone need a GSA contract?
No, as a matter of fact, with certain areas, I would stay away from GSA, not all of them. Some of them, you're better to be in GSA, but GSA has a clause in it. And this is why, you know, companies should talk with some experts in what they're trying to do. But GSA has a clause called the price reduction clause. And that clause basically says that you can't sell your product or service at a cheaper price commercially than you do to the government.
Right.
So I actually, in some areas, discourage clients from going after a GSA contract because you can get yourself in a tight spot if a client comes to you to negotiate, you're willing to negotiate, and we all are a lot of times, and you offer a price lower than what you've offered to the government in the past. And you might think that it's pretty simple to keep from doing that, but it happens all the time where you've got a salesman who goes out and makes a deal while you're negotiating something on the government side and find out that you just gave that guy a lower price. So that can get you in some trouble, and the government will ask for payback on things like that. So no, you do not have to have a GSA schedule to go after government work, but sometimes it's very helpful. Some clients do need it. And in those instances, we do go after them for them.
So that might be, and everyone will, as long as you meet all the criteria, everyone can be awarded a GSA, right? There's not a
absolutely
a lot of stringent criteria there.
Yeah, absolutely. You need invoices from commercial sales that to show your pricing in the past. And you need to know what products you want to put on the schedule and be able to give a good description on them. And then you submit to the government, and you basically have a contract between you and the government that allows the government to buy directly from you if they want. They also have a website where the government can buy some of the products directly from the website. It's called GSA Advantage, but you have to have the schedule before you can get on GSA Advantage.
Okay. And that's an open site. I can go there and look and see who has a GSA contract as well, can't I?
Yes, and it's open, and it's open bidding too. So you don't have to meet some certain deadline to submit a GSA schedule. Typically takes, GSA schedules are big. You know, if you were to stack all the paperwork on a table, it's probably well over a foot high. But it's almost all done electronically now, where you're submitting electronically. But the GSA schedules are hard to do just because there's so much paperwork to do. But typically you can have it done in about a month, and the government takes about 3 to 6 months to make sure everything's okay before they give you that contract. Because again, with a GSA contract, then you have basically proven to the government that you are selling that product commercially, and that the government is getting the best price, and they don't have to renegotiate that price.
Does it grease the skids in any way for other contracts, subsequent contract bids that you might be interested in, to say, see GSA contract? I mean,
it certainly makes it easy if you go and meet with a client that you don't have a contract with already, and the government is interested in what you do. It certainly makes it easy for them to get to you if they're that interested, where you could say, look, you don't even have to put out a contract and do any extra work. You can get to me through this GSA contract.
So the process is different for state and local government, right?
It is. I actually find the federal government to be easier. The paperwork in the federal government is kind of standardized. You know, there's different sections of solicitations, and you always know what those sections are. Now, not every solicitation has every section, but all of them follow the same criteria, right? So Schedule B or Section B is your costing section. Sections L and M are your how they're going to evaluate and also what the award criteria is. So, and instructions for bidding. So you start to learn which sections you have to pay the most attention to. But state and local is not bound by some larger process, right? So in the state of Pennsylvania or the state of Texas, you have to register with both governments. You can't just register with one state and be able to do state work in every state. And Texas is going to have different rules than Pennsylvania for getting whatever your requirements are to become qualified to do business with them. With the federal government, once you're registered in SAM, you can do any federal work in any state or country that they're doing federal work in.
So that process is, the criteria is different. The forms and the documentation and what's required to be submitted is completely different. Do you help companies who want to win state contracts? Is that something you guys do?
Yeah, we do. We actually have clients that do both state and federal work and even local work, but what we can't do is actually do the registrations for you, right? It has to come from your company IP addresses. So we can walk you through what you need to put into certain sections. And sometimes it's challenging, right? Where you've got companies that have things you've never seen before. You have to figure that out, right? But we can help walk them through all that to get them registered. And then we help them build the strategy by working the pipeline and bidding things that they're interested in over time.
So we're obviously in sort of the midst of, hopefully at the end of a pandemic here with COVID-19, as we kind of enter the winter of 2020. So what impact has that had on the way people do business with the government, or the way the government is doing business today? I mean, has there been any material change in the processes, or, you know, is it any easier or any more difficult for businesses to pursue this strategy?
So one of the things we didn't talk about earlier was one of the advantages of working with the federal government is the federal government is recession resistant, what we call recession resistant. And so what that means is, during times of recession or national crisis, the government actually spends more money, not less. When the commercial market is contracting because people are spending less money, the government spends more. And it does it for a very good reason. They do that to spur the economy back on, right? So during recessions, it actually can be an offset to downtimes. And during the national crisis that we're currently in, the pandemic, what I saw was, for certain things, the bid process got more simple. things like PPE, where the government would reach out to industry and say, tell me everything you have in PPE and we will award you a contract. And as we need stuff, we will come back to you. Other things have slowed down, right? So, you know, that people aren't sitting in their offices, people aren't traveling. So you see travel dollars are contracting within the government and also on the commercial side as well. That people aren't sitting in the offices, so you're not having meetings. They're just putting out the solicitations and people are bidding on them. Makes it a little more difficult. But all in all, the federal market is one place you want to be in no matter what your company is, because during downtimes, the government can actually help you to make up your gap. If you've already been in with them and have some past performance, you actually can be in a better position. You know, the question a lot of people ask is, over the last at least 20 years, close to 20 years, you know, everybody says, hey, where were you on 9/11? But the question a business should be asking themselves is, where were you on 9/12? Because on 9/12, the country for the most part was shut down, and they were shut down for about 10 days. Not everybody was shut down, but a lot of it was. And I worked for the federal government at the time, and the federal government doesn't shut down. So on 9/12, I was right back in my chair just outside the Pentagon where the plane hit. And the reason I was is because I still had a job to do and it was related to the federal government. During the pandemic, a lot of companies shut down. I had clients that the federal government sent them letters saying you're allowed to continue to operate in your state because we need the resources that you're providing to us. So they actually gave me a copy of that letter so I could travel within the state. And if I got pulled over, I could show that I was doing work for the federal government that actually allowed me to continue to do my job. So there are reasons why you would want to be in the federal government during times of national crisis or recession, and people should pay attention to that.
So having at least a piece of your business associated with the federal government is just good, sound business practices. At a certain point, at a certain scale of an operation, it should almost be required. You should really have that in place.
Yeah, and some companies do it without actually being in the federal government, right? Some companies do it by being a subcontractor with piece parts to other larger companies. But I would say for the most part, most companies should be looking at whether or not they should be doing business with the federal government. Of course, you want to make sure you understand what kind of bids are out there and what the market looks like. But I think that it's actually good, sound business practice to have some portion of your business tied to recession-resistant types of opportunities.
That brings up a thought. So there are massive, as we know, massive defense contractors and government contractors out there who get these billion-dollar awards, right? They can't do all that work themselves. So they oftentimes will sub out pieces and parts of that work to smaller businesses. And I think, and correct me if I'm wrong here, but in some cases, the government actually requires that they sub a portion of the contract out to small businesses or underutilized or disadvantaged organizations. Can you talk a little bit about that dynamic?
Yeah, so actually, that's a great point. Actually, it's federal mandate. They have to, right, for full and open competitions by large businesses, they have to actually write a small business contracting plan that is submitted as part of your proposal back to the government. And the government has requirements not only for small business participation, but for all the disadvantaged companies we talked about earlier. So those large companies like Lockheed Martin and DRS and some of those companies, they're looking for disadvantaged companies and small businesses to round out their teams to meet the requirements for the government. So, you know, having friends in high places can be helpful.
So would you help me if I wanted that business, if I didn't think I had an application to sell directly to the federal government, but I thought I could be a sub to a prime, I think that's what they still call them, right? To a prime contract holder. Would you help me figure out what those opportunities are, or am I on my own hunting for those?
No, we actually help with that as well, right? So again, part of the pipeline strategy is to look at even large bids that have already been let and somebody won them and find out who the incumbent is. Because if you can find that out, then at a minimum, you can at least put your clients in front of those potential contract holders to say, hey, look, we've got a capability. We're a certain type of small business. And, whether it's disadvantaged or regular small business, and are you meeting that goal? Or are you happy with the contractors you have? To have a good understanding or the at least put it in the mind of that company that there's other people out there who can help. And I can tell you that the government itself struggles with meeting small business goals. Within the disadvantaged areas, they have goals they have to meet as well. And there's just simply not enough disadvantaged businesses to be able to meet those goals on a regular basis.
So I've seen monkey business over the years around this idea of disadvantaged businesses where, you know, someone's wife, you know, becomes the owner of the company, or a key employee who's maybe of some protected class or whatever gets gifted some share of the business. Yeah. So my guess is you've probably seen some of that stuff yourself over the years. So what's the risk in using one of those strategies, or is there at all?
Well, the rules have changed a little bit, and I can't speak to how stringent they are because I don't own a disadvantage myself, so I'm not going after disadvantage work. But what I can say is the criteria now for some of those that require certification, like the 8A, the SDVOSB, and HubZone type companies, you have to be able to prove that the owner of that company is involved in that business, right? You have to be able to prove that they're managing that company, that they're managing whatever the strategy is or the finances or whatever their background is. That didn't used to be the case, I don't think, but I can't tell you exactly what that criteria is because I'm not one of those in any of those categories. Right. So I don't register myself. I help other companies register themselves. And those are the types of conversations that you have during the certification process with the government to say, yes, I'm doing X, Y, and Z.
Right. So I think you may have mentioned this before. So you mentioned SAM.gov, or I think that was it, where you can look for available contracts to bid on. I don't know if I had that right, but what other maybe free resources are there for someone who's interested in just investigating the possibilities here?
The to search for the bids, it's actually beta.sam.gov.
Okay.
But the other resources that I know of are not free. Now, there are state and local level resources that you can look at, but there are other resources that you can get that are as good, if not better, than Beta SAM. One of them is govwin.com. GovWin, in my opinion, is the gold standard, but GovWin is not cheap. It costs some money to get it, even for a small company. I've used governmentbids.com. You can get a lot of state level stuff in governmentbids.com, but those are not free resources. You have to pay for those. But BetaSAM is free, and it's a government website. There's also once you're registered with the government, you can get in what's called dibs.gov, and that's a DLA website for supplies that they buy that you can go into and look at bids that they have upcoming and things like that. I mentioned Seaport E, some of the contracts like GSA, once you're on GSA, you can go into GSA and look at upcoming bids from them. There's lots of them, but the main one where the government puts out the bids is typically beta.sam.gov.
And if anyone was interested in that, they could find a company like yours that helps facilitate this bidding process, and they could reach out to you and come up with an arrangement to have you help them do some research. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. We do research on a lot of different ways. Not even just looking for bids, but we look at government websites to gain insight into government organizations. And again, that helps the company to determine who they need to speak to within an organization within the government. So we do all that kind of research. We look at, again, partners and competition and how much the government has spent. So the spending cycle of the government, we look at all that kind of stuff.
That's great. Well, that's fascinating. Well, look, Tim, I really appreciate your time today. Really interesting stuff. I think I think my takeaway here is if you have a product or service that there's a good chance the government is buying that product or service, and you should at least investigate. You owe it to your business and your shareholders and your employees to investigate whether or not there's an opportunity for you to pursue a government contract or multiple government contracts as a strategy for growth.
Yeah, at an absolute minimum, you know, I would find somebody who can research for you and just ask the question, hey, based on what I do, can you tell me what it looks like in the federal market? Because anybody who has a background like our company has can get that information for you, or should be able to get that information for you. So at an absolute minimum, asking yourself, is it worth exploring and finding somebody who will, you know, give you that information just so you can make an informed decision is worth your time.
Right. Well, thanks so much, Tim. So speaking of that, if someone wants to talk to you, what's the best way for someone to reach you or your company?
Well, we have a company website. It's called McAllisterBrown.com. My email address is tbrown@McAllisterBrown.com. And I always have my cell phone. I might not answer right away, but I always call back. And it's 301-788-9329.
Perfect. Well, look, we'll put your contact information in the notes for the podcast on our website. And so if you're listening to this, not in a place where you can write that contact information down, just go check out prosalesconnection.com/podcast and look for today's episode with Tim Brown. Well, look, thank you so much for Tim. Before I wrap up, I wanted to take a minute just to thank everyone for following the podcast. We're getting a lot of traction right now. It's really exciting to see the momentum building. So I really appreciate everyone following and sharing our podcast with your friends and colleagues. If you like what we're doing, I'd be grateful if you could give me a 5-star review on iTunes. It really helps us be found. That's the iTunes algorithm. So the more reviews, the more comments you get, the more discoverable your podcast is. So if you haven't done that already, please take a minute and do that for me. I'd really appreciate it. If you've done it already, thanks so much. I'm really grateful for that. That's it for today. Thanks for listening. And remember that B2B leaders grow companies faster when they focus on the big three. Thanks. Have a great day.
Pro Sales Connection is a sales and marketing firm that has been helping B2B companies grow faster since 2009. Learn more about our proprietary fastest path to revenue process for B2B companies. Experiencing the possibilities begins with a short 15-minute call. Schedule yours at www.prosalesconnection.com and click Get Started.